It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Did you have a good holiday?
Did.
We did.
Yes.
All right. A little...
Missed you, though.
Yeah.
We were hoping you would stop by.
I wanted to. All right, let's dive in. Not a lot on local this week, but it appears the bridge that's being built already is sinking.
Yeah, it's not a bridge nowhere yet, but it could be. Report out of Como TV and other sources talking this week about the new 520 bridge that's being built across Evergreen Point, and the fact that the company in Grays Harbor that is actually a very large construction company that gets contracts all over the country, Hewitt Construction, has been building the pontoons for that new bridge. And they haven't been building it very well. A former instructor saying the quality of the first pontoons built in Aberdeen was so shoddy that it is, quote, a disaster waiting to happen. They've also allegedly laid off several inspectors for refusing to sign off on their defective work. A Washington State Department of Transportation audit found, quote, a pattern of noncompliance and failure to implement corrective action on the part of Hewitt, and that WashDOT failed to hold the contractor responsible. And this is not the first time that this has happened with Hewitt. They've had a couple of projects down in California that have run into similar problems. In particular, they've been talking with a 520 bridge about not setting the concrete correctly in the pontoons. They're doing it when it's too cold and it's too wet, and thus the quality of the concrete is not very good and not likely to last very well.
And so the pontoons are leaking, and, you know, the repairs that they've made on the pontoons were supposed to, you know, they admitted that, oh, yes, there's some cracking some of the pontoons are leaking. We'll make repairs. And WashDOT has said that, yes, those repairs are good and has cleared them. They're not. Yeah, several of the pontoons are still leaking.
And this is exactly the same thing that's happened in California with the Bay Bridge, and also a bridge northeast of San Francisco in Benicia Martinez, where they've had cracking concrete with exactly the same kinds of problems. The question here is, of course, number one, why is WashDOT still defending these folks? And the answer is the same answer that they ran into in California when the Caltrans down there was at first defending Hewitt also, which is that this is a very large and well-connected construction company, and they don't want to say bad things about them, and particularly since they're also based in Washington State. The question then arises, do you really want to drive across that bridge once it opens?
Yeah, given that it's going to be a floating bridge, who wants to drive on it when you know that the pontoons are leaking? And WashDOT also said that, Hewitt understands, we've discussed this with Hewitt, and they understand that they need to make changes so that when they do the phase two, the second set of pontoons, that they will be of better quality. However, Como has heard that from folks working on the second or looking at the second set of pontoons that they also have cracking problems. So clearly this is a problem inside the company with quality control, and they're taking taxpayer money, but they're not producing the product that we're paying them for.
But they are making changes. They're laying off the inspectors that are calling them on it.
And that
alone tells you exactly where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So this is a multi-billion-dollar project.
Yeah, this is a big about $3 billion, I think, for the 520 bridge.
Yeah, you know, were working on the Bay Bridge down in California, and the Bay Bridge project is several billion dollars, $6.5 billion, I think. And they're looking at it now, going, is it safe to drive across? It's nearly done. You know, they're going to be completing it soon. And the main issue is with the work done by Hewitt. Group.
And bear in mind with the Bay Bridge, they had a history during the, I believe it was the 1989 earthquake, where the Bay Bridge literally lost some sections in the earthquake.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're vulnerable to earthquakes here, too. And we're also vulnerable with a floating bridge, to the as happened with the initial I-90 bridge, with the darn thing just sinking.
Well, and high winds, because we get wind storms here.
Like last week.
The floating bridges have to be able to handle that.
Tacoma Narrows Bridge.
Yep. Galloping Gertie. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
So. All right. Let's move on to national, well, both local and national, with Walmart.
Yeah. The group, Our Walmart, they have organized, they organized about 1,000 different protests at 1,000 different Walmart stores around Black Friday yesterday. And several of those protests went off, including some locally. Last week, Walmart issued a complaint with the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, trying to stop our Walmart from organizing protests.
Which is pretty amusing, since the NLRB is supposed to be about organized labor and Walmart doesn't recognize unions.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Walmart said that they assume that our Walmart is undergoing, with these protests, undergoing a unionization drive. However, that's not the focus of the protests at all. Our Walmart has said, and it's very clear when you go to their website and when you see the promotional material for the protests and when you read the testimonials of Walmart employees who have walked off the job to join strikes and to join the protests, that the protests are about working conditions at Walmart. It's about addressing employee grievances, and particularly when it comes to low pay, not being scheduled enough hours in order to make a decent living wage, being given schedules that are inconsistent so you can't make any family plans, being forced to work on holidays, and having to see their benefits decline, having to pay more out-of-pocket costs for things like health care.
Yeah.
So, and Walmart, also that Walmart retaliates against employees who complain and protest.
Yeah, and Walmart really was one of the original companies that started doing scheduling practices that specifically managed to give employees just few enough hours that they wouldn't qualify for things like benefits and flexible schedules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, given that in the current legal and political environment in the U.S., it's practically impossible to unionize a company as large as Walmart, which has over 10,000 stores all over the world, employees, when they can't unionize, they really need to do whatever is left to them, and in this case, it is organizing protests store to store and across the U.S. as much as they possibly can in order to try to make the company shift and make changes in their company-wide practices. They do have support from the United Food and Commercial Workers, because Walmart has driven unionized stores out of business and they've lowered wages and benefits across the whole industry. There are many unionized grocery stores and other stores that no longer are in business because Walmart moves into a community and puts the smaller stores out of business.
Always the lowest wage. Always.
Yes, indeed. So it was great to see the Walmart complaint filed with the NLRB, which was to try to get the NLRB to issue an injunction to stop our Walmart from holding protests. That didn't stop them at all.
Yeah, and it shouldn't, because it's a free speech issue, number one. And oh yes, just because Black Friday is over and Buy Nothing Day is over, that doesn't mean it's okay to buy things today.
Moving on, congressional related news, starting with the tax reform.
Yeah, you know, this week there have been a lot of negotiations over tax reform to try to avert the fiscal cliff. And in case folks don't remember, I don't know how you could forget what the fiscal cliff is, because there's so much talk about it.
The gentle fiscal incline.
Yes, yes. It's the gentle fiscal downhill slope. As of the end of the year, the Bush-era tax cuts are set to expire. And this is at the same time that certain automatic budget cuts will kick in, that because Congress has not been able to come up with a plan for addressing the budget.
This is the sequestration.
So there's a lot of talks going on, last minute sort of talks in the lame duck Congress to try to come up with a solution for dealing with finding additional money to cover, the budget deficit. And, Obama came out and said right after the election, he said, what I want to do, this, you know, the fact that I won the election means that Americans support my view that I want to raise taxes on folks who make more than $250,000 a year. And he wants to raise top tax rates by a couple of percentage points, from 35% to about 37%. And now that's the nominal rate. That's not the effective rate. Most rich folks pay a lot less than 37%. You only have to look at Mitt Romney's tax returns to realize that. Now, the Republicans in Congress, they're saying, oh, no tax increase. And you have to ask them, why the heck not? You know, he's only talking about a couple percentage
points. And it's actually not even a tax increase. What it is an expiration of a tax cut.
Yes, exactly. And that's the reason why.
Of a temporary tax cut.
The Bush tax cuts were, they could only get passed really during, while Bush was in office, because they had an expiration date set on them. Because the Democrats would only go along with it. And many Republicans would only go along with it knowing that it was a temporary tax cut.
And even then, they had to get through the Senate with reconciliation because they couldn't get any more than 50 votes. They couldn't get the 60 to block the filibuster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I want to point out, too, that Obama's only talking about a 37% top rate. Under Clinton, the top rate was 39%, and that was a cut from the mid-1980s, just prior to the first big tax cut passed by the Reagan, passed during the Reagan years, the Tax Reform Act of 1986. The top tax rate was 50%. And if you look back to the 1950s, which was one of the best decades of the last century for growth.
Overseen by a Republican president.
Yeah, for growth in the American economy in the mid-1950s, the top tax rate was 91%. And there were 14 different tax brackets for wealthy people. Now there's only two. There's 33 and there's 35%. In the Clinton era, there were only two, 36% and that 39%. And so I think, yes, it's not unreasonable to ask wealthy to pay a little more, or even just to pay what they were paying during the Clinton administration.
All right. Also, privacy-related issues, the emails.
Yeah. Let me see here. Just find that. Yeah, the Senate is going to vote next week on a bill to update the 1986 Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It's a substitute bill for H.R. 2471, which was originally written to require law enforcement agencies to get a warrant in order to access. They have to get a warrant signed by a judge with probable cause in order to get access to your email or access to any of your internet accounts. That was the idea behind that bill. Now, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont has made some changes in response to law enforcement officials. They put pressure on him so that in September he withdrew the bill and rewrote large portions of it. Now the bill that they're going to vote on next week would grant access to your email to over 22 different federal agencies without requiring a warrant. And some of those agencies include the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Maritime Commission, the Postal Regulatory Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, the National Mine Enforcement Safety and Health Review Commission, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. You have to look at that list and go, what? These people can see my email and they're not required to get a warrant for it. So the bill permits them to see accounts even on university networks, and it requires internet service providers to notify law enforcement before they can tell you that your email has been compromised. And there's no particular time limit in which they have to do it. It says that there can be a delay of 3 to 10 days, but up to a year before they tell you that anyone has been given access to see your emails. And there's some pretty severe problems with that. If we even just thinking about, for example, what happened with David Petraeus and his email. Here's the head of the CIA. He can't have any private email communications. Well, you know, what do you think is going to happen to you? In particular, this is worrisome because so many high-tech companies are coming out with devices that urge you to store your data on the cloud, in other words, on the internet, where it can be easily accessed in this manner. So I urge people to call your senators and tell them not to vote for this very bad bill, substitute for H.R. 2471.
All right. Moving on, recommendation out this week for AIDS testing?
Yeah, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is looks at these standards for the CDC, putting out a report this week calling for most Americans between the ages of 15 to 64 to be tested for HIV, even people who do not think they're particularly at risk for it. Also part of that proposal that Medicare and most private insurers will be required to pay for that testing. there are some fairly good rationales, actually, for that recommendation, even if you don't think you're at risk. One of them being that catching HIV earlier, they now understand, means far more effective treatment for it. And now that with the retrovirals, there are is this effective treatment for it. Near universal testing would also remove the stigma that a lot of people feel, both for taking the test, for employers and others finding out that you've taken the test, et cetera. And then, of course, obviously, people lie about their sexual behavior to spouses, to doctors, and so forth all the time. The downside to this, of course, is that you are testing a lot of people who are not at all at risk for this. And, you know, in general, the U.S. medical system insists on far more laboratory testing than any other healthcare system in the world. And it is very expensive and is a prime contributor to the overall rising cost of healthcare. So it'll be interesting to see whether these recommendations are actually adopted down the road or not. And once again, you know, we have a case where a good functioning public healthcare system is expensive, but it's a lot less expensive when you're not inserting for-profit middle people and companies into the equation as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a difference between testing people for something that could kill them, and if you spread it around to other people who never get tested could kill those folks as well, versus testing people for something that they probably don't have, but you want to make the profit to run the test anyway.
All right. On to the return of the alternate universe.
Yes, you may be wondering where it's been. Well, the alternate universe has been there all along this month. We've just been ignoring it. But Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who is the suddenly the great brown hope for the Republican Party in 2016, now that they've noticed that people with darker skin don't like them, was in the news this week. He did an interview as part of the launching of his 2016 presidential campaign with GQ magazine, which asked him, so, Senator Rubio, how old do you think the Earth is? Now, this wouldn't normally be a question that you would feel a need to ask an elected official, except that, well, this is the Republican Party. And sure enough, his answer, I'm not a scientist, man. I can tell you what recorded history says. I can tell you what the Bible says. But I think that's a dispute among theologians. I'm not a scientist. I don't think I'm qualified to answer a question like that. At the end of the day... Now, mind you, this is a question that could have been answered with two words.
Right.
at the end of the day, I think there are multiple theories out there on how the universe was created. And I think this is a country where people should have the opportunity to teach them all. I think that parents should be able to teach their kids what their faith says, what science says, whether the Earth was created in 7 days or 7 actual eras. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to answer that. It's one of the great mysteries.
No.
So
I like how he said it was a dispute for theologians and not a dispute for geologists.
Yeah. So Senator Rubio, what's 2 + 2? Well, the scientists say 4 and the theologians say 7. And I that's also among the great mysteries. I don't think we'll ever know.
All right. Anything
else?
This is
the great hope for the Republican Party here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else from that universe?
No. Let's go back. Let's come back to our own. Thank you.
Okay. And our own is not looking so well. Moving on to international, starting with Gaza.
Yeah. Ceasefire this week on the shelling of Gaza by Israel and the shooting of rockets by Palestinian militants into Israel. The brokering of that agreement came down to two people. It was Mohamed Morsi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood and the president of Egypt, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton doing a bunch of what used to be called shuttle diplomacy. The interesting part of that, of course, was Morsi's role, because you heard from a number of Israel backers when the Muslim Brotherhood ascended to power in Egypt, that they're out for the destruction of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. You just had the head of the Muslim Brotherhood doing Israel an enormous favor by brokering that ceasefire, because Israel was not really accomplishing anything militarily in terms of its shelling, but it was isolating itself enormously internationally by doing it. you know, finding a face-saving way out of that situation was very, very helpful for them. At the same time, you know, the Gazans who were subjected to this, and of course many, many people were killed in the course of this shelling, you know, it just means the infrastructure is that much more destroyed. It's that much more difficult to be living in the Gaza Strip now, and they are absolutely no closer to getting any kind of an end to the occupation or any kind of recognition that they have, in fact, as well as in theory,
the borders.
A country of their own.
Yeah.
All right. Bahrain.
Yeah, Amnesty International released a report on Bahrain this week. The government of Bahrain, according to Amnesty, has not made the promised reforms since last year's crackdown on democracy protesters. A commission that was a human rights commission that was convened last year looked at what happened to protesters during the crackdown in early 2011. And in November of 2011, the commission issued a report saying that, yes, Bahrain needed to make some pretty big changes to the way they handled dissenters, particularly those that had been in jail or had been in prison, had been tortured and sexually abused. Now, the Bahrain government made promises that it would make changes. However, Amnesty says no, they haven't made those changes, and in fact, they've expanded political oppression. The nightly protests continue in spite of a government ban on protests. Political prisoners continue to be beaten, tortured, and sexually assaulted, and no high-ranking law enforcement officers have been tried or sentenced for human rights abuses. Amnesty also criticized the United States and Britain for not putting pressure on the Bahrain government. Bahrain, of course, is where the U.S. bases its fifth fleet in the Gulf region. Bahrain has also recently stripped dissidents of citizenship, basically kicking them out of the country if they're already in exile. They've removed their citizenship. And, of course, Bahrain has, over the past year, imprisoned a number of doctors and other healthcare workers for treating injured protesters. And that's a direct violation of international law.
All right. Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Washington Post got coming out with an interesting story this week that the U.S. is refusing to abide by an agreed upon schedule and turn over administration of its prisons in Afghanistan to the Afghan government. And the sticking point, one of the main sticking points, is that the U.S. government wants Afghanistan to continue holding certain prisoners it views as dangerous, even if there is not evidence to try them. That is a direct quote. That includes 50 Afghans already ordered released by Afghan courts. In other words, what the U.S. is doing here is saying that we want the Afghan government to hold people without charges indefinitely, the exact same detention without charges that the U.S. regularly condemns in countries like Iran, Syria, Uzbekistan, and Libya, and of course condemned for many years in Burma until you had Obama and Clinton
which they tolerate
doing a photo op
in other countries, like in Bahrain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The same week, the U.S. was also protesting the Iraqi government's release of Ali Musa Daqouq. He's suspected in the 2007 killing of five U.S. soldiers. An Iraqi court had ordered a release for lack of evidence of Daqouq. And once again, you have the U.S. pressuring a government that it basically installed by effecting regime change on the previous government there in order to, quote-unquote, bring freedom and democracy to, in this case, Iraq. And the U.S. now insisting that Iraq also hold somebody without charges that a court has ordered to be released and that there is not evidence to charge on a particular crime. That's number one. And number two, in the case of Daqouq, in Iraq, is exactly how many charges have there been of Americans, either soldiers or civilian contractors, for the killing of Iraqi soldiers, let alone Iraqi civilians in Iraq. And of course, the question is absolutely none, even though well over a million people died as a result of the U.S. invasion and occupation there. So a good deal of tension between the U.S. and Iraqi governments this week over that little standoff as well.
Once again, we're trying to bring democracy to the Middle East and the rest of the world.
Yes, and
not doing a very good job.
To go back to the old Emma Goldman quote, who are we to export democracy when we're so poor in it ourselves?
Yeah.
All right. A potential new trading bloc in Asia?
Yeah, to coincide with the Obama Obama's trip to Burma, you know, one of the things that has been discussed about Obama's past year in office is this shift towards Asia, away from the Middle East. It's a very interesting development happened this week. The 10 nations of ASEAN, the Asian trading bloc in which the U.S. plays a dominant role, decided that they were going to negotiate a trade pact without the U.S. They were going to form their own new trading bloc with six more nations, including Australia, India, Japan, New Zealand, South Korea, and China, who is not a member of the U.S. U.S. trading bloc. And they said that, of course, uniting in this new trade bloc means that the new trade bloc will cover about half the world's population by 2015. So I found this very interesting. And this comes right after the Obama administration had set up their own Trans-Pacific Partnership, which doesn't include China, to negotiate trade deals and to try to deal with the South China Sea problem.
And oddly enough, China actually is in Asia and the United States
is not. Yes.
All right. And some hackers are facing trial.
Anonymous, the worldwide hacker group that sprung up a couple of years ago in response to the WikiLeaks imbroglio. Four of the hackers from Anonymous have become the first ones from that era to go on trial this week in London for denial of service attacks against some of the companies that the U.S. Government inspired to crack down on WikiLeaks a couple of years ago. MasterCard and Visa and Bank of America and some of the companies serving companies that were trying to make it hard for WikiLeaks to exist, even though WikiLeaks itself had never been charged of, let alone convicted of any crime. Well, the companies that denied them service, based on no real pretext whatsoever, were also never charged with any crime. But the hackers who attacked the credit card companies and banks were, and now four of them are on trial in London. There's another 13 that are expected to go on trial in the United States early in 2013. But it's interesting that the first ones are coming up in London because, of course, Britain has much more difficult laws in terms of freedom of speech, in terms of protecting freedom of speech. Probably makes it easier to get a conviction on some of these. Also, much less in the way of electronic privacy, although, as the earlier item suggests, that's going away in this country, too. It'll be very interesting to see how that trial plays out, because if people can get convicted in the UK, chances are going to be pretty grim for them here as well.
And meanwhile, Julian Assange still remains in the Ecuadorian embassy.
That is correct. He's spending a quality year in the embassy. Hold up in London.
And Bradley Manning still remains in prison.
In prison. He's no longer in 24/7 solitary confinement, thanks to public pressure, but he is still in prison and he still has not been charged or tried.
All right. How about some events?
Yeah, tomorrow night, great panel that has been put together on very short notice around the crisis in Gaza with Richard Silverstein, who's a national Middle East blogger who's based here in Seattle, and several Palestinian and Israeli activists who are also here in the Northwest. That will be 7 o'clock tomorrow night at University Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. Also on Wednesday, November 28th, also at University Temple, will be progressive folk singer David Rovix, who's been around for many, many years, puts on a great show. He'll be in concert at University Temple. $10, but nobody turned away for lack of money, and that is at 6:30 on Wednesday evening, the 28th.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my material at mariatomchik.com.